Thanks very much, Carmen. We're privileged to have you as a critic in this country. And one of the things that I appreciate when I read your criticism as a person who makes their living as a freelance writer is just how readable it is, which is not to say that it is not thoughtful and thorough, but it's also just fun to read. I think we should praise good writing, and good writing can find its place within literary criticism. We don't have to ghettoize writing. I think one of the things that has happened in North America, for whatever reason, is that people who work in, as I do, as a freelancer in the trade market, in a sense, it almost stigmatizes you in terms of your literary career, whereas I think if we went south of the equator, we'd find all kinds of wonderful examples of people who, like Marquez, like Eduardo Galeano, who have worked as journalists and made significant contributions to their literature. It's really a privilege to read with Jeff, not only because I love him, but because he's such a fine poet. I'm reading from a long work, a narrative poem, some 90 pages long, so I'm still trying to find the places I should be reading, because we're not going to keep you here for the whole thing. It's a work that I've had in mind for a long time. It's titled A Ship Portrait. Ship portraiture was very much part of the culture of the Maritimes in the 19th century, when we were going through our boom economic times. Ship's captains and owners would commission, usually self-taught painters, to do a portrait of their ship. And if you grew up in the Maritimes, as I did, you saw them hanging in parlors and hanging in libraries. And, it was very much part of our culture. In 1984, I saw a retrospective exhibition by a ship portraitist by the name of John O'Brien. And I had for a long time felt that I had to address this period in my history as a poet. And O'Brien presented himself to me as a promising lens to look at this period, because much has been written about the sailing vessels, about sailors, about the captains, about the economy. I wanted all that stuff in the poem, actually, but I needed to find someone to carry the weight of all that material, and O'Brien seemed to be the one, at least for me, taking this poetic route. O'Brien was an Irish immigrant, or the son of an Irish immigrant, reputedly born at sea. And the poem proceeds chronologically, and I'm going to begin with his birth date. And we don't know a whole lot about O'Brien's life, in fact, other than the art that he has left us. And so I've used the paintings as a chronology to pace the poem. But we'll begin on his birthday, 30th November 1831. You're going to hear two voices here. O'Brien's, which is written in blank verse, and my own answering poem, which is written, I suppose, in free verse. 30th November 1831. I was born at sea, slipped my mother into the slop of a worm-eaten ship. My first cries mingled with Tur and Tickleace, the grand banks halfway between the Green Island and the New World. I was Janus, looking both ways, one more starving mouth fleeing the English blight. Some say this is myth, self-made to increase my fame. Some say it was another John O'Brien, a common enough name, who was seaborne, or even a brother stillborn, a dark double to follow me all my days. But it was I, John O'Brien, artist who was first rocked in the bowels of a ship, who came ashore, newborn, in St. John Town. So what if you were not born at sea, O'Brien? Art is myth-making, memory becoming, regardless of history. The artist is a life lived backwards. I'm going to jump forward now to 1850, which is the date of the earliest painting that we have of O'Brien's, which now hangs in the National Gallery. It's a small work, simply entitled Yacht Race, and he painted this during a yacht race in Halifax Harbor. The officers got up a regatta. Already my sketch of the flagship and squadron southbound for Bermuda had been celebrated in the Nova Scotian. I was not yet 19. The clouds cleared while the wind north-northwest off the land filled the sails but hardly rippled the harbor. Half the town decked out in holiday colors gathered at the dock. The rum and bets went down. The Pyramus, Nelson's proud booty, flew a pyramid of flags, gunwale to topmast. Sloops, schooners, cutters, and yawls tacked about the old lady like sea dancers coupled in feverish reel or quadrille. I kept watch to freeze this motion. In the fifth race, I saw what I was looking for. Mystery, eclipse, wanderer, close hauled on the port tack. Looking back, these three might have been my fates. That day I attended to the sea, set of sail, sky, and its gathering fleet of torn clouds. What is a ship without the sky's weather? Even Ruskin knew that, Turner too. The canvas is a mirror for cloud light. The rain cloud, Ruskin said, carries its own wind. It reveals all that is beautiful, conceals all that is harmful, makes the paltry look vast, the ponderous light and airy. Skipper, balanced on her bow, mystery tacked into the sky's dark embrace, a foreboding my eye could not ignore. Mystery peeled over, the ivory spray scrimshawed her black hull. Her pursuers fell off the right margin of my canvas. Everything rushed away, soundless, while the picture composed itself. A very clever specimen, they said. Who knows what posterity will preserve O'Brien? Something, we pray. Perhaps it is not all for naught. This was an early, the yacht race was kind of an early amateur sketch before he took up the trade of being a ship portraitist. I guess the tragedy of being a ship portraitist was that you, what was in the picture in a sense was prescribed by the buyer. And I don't think O'Brien was constitutionally able to carry that out throughout his whole career, which was somewhat of his downfall. But he did, for a period of time, adhere to the formula, give the buyer what they wanted. This particular piece from 1855, so we're 5 years on in his life now, we don't know the ship, so I've simply entitled it Portrait of a Ship, 1855. Now I began to knock them off, one every week or so. I always gave them what they wanted under full sail, as if I were painting their own portraits. How do men become wood, iron, hemp, and canvas? Or is it the wind, waves, and scudding skies we wear on our guts, on our faces? We are all prone to becoming what we make, captive to our own manic compass. Show them in the harbor, landfall or departure, either way within sight of land, lighthouse, headland or island to port or starboard. Show them the certainty of payoff, the promise of good passage, the pilot ship close by, the burden of navigation lifted. The ships grow and grow, no longer infinitesimal specks, mere pencil crosses on the flat ocean of the track chart. They fly their house flags like badges of courage. They are not yet lost, condemned, broken up, cut down, or sold. In my art, they would always be whole. For this flattery, they paid me. In my art, the winds were always propitious, the way clear, the owner's fortune assured, the portrait granted them what fate withholds. Look closely at these pictures of perfection. You may see the vanity of commerce, but always the sky is making weather, the sea's cruel undercurrent is pulling the enterprise toward the patient rocks, the violet in the clouds, each wavelet conjures doubt, foreshadowing disaster. You gave them what they wanted, O'Brien. Who could blame you for that? After all, you had a living to make. You gave us what we now need, not just the faithful record of the ships, their cut and rig, but an image of a better time, outward looking, not close hauled against the shore, insular. Still, we sit in judgment, spew epithets, primitive, hack, potboiler, provincial, naive, as if we did not see ourselves better after you had portrayed us as stately ships. In the end, when the broker's fortunes are spent, the heroics of iron men acted out, what is left but your art? So the merchants of Halifax saw the promise of this young man and they decided that he needed training. So they got a collection together and sent him to England to study under a master marine painter by the name of J.W. Carmichael, who really was a Turner imitator. I don't know whether O'Brien saw Turner, but I certainly imagine he did when I look at his later work. So this is dated 11th November 1857 and is presented as a letter to O'Brien's father, who, by the way, was a barber, just as Turner's father was. They both displayed their first paintings in the barber shop of their father. He was very close. O'Brien was very close to his father. We know about. Dear father, my master, J.W. Carmichael, Esquire, is not long back from the Baltic campaign. His work in the Illustrated London News is known to me. All said, I could not find a better teacher. In my first work, he found little to correct. Why then had I come? The fresh sea, midday with a blue streak in the sky, is his credo. Give them what they see or want to see, he says. Then they will buy. You can see there was little to learn in England, that is, until I saw Turner, the shipwreck, and Dutch boats in a gale. Carmichael's seas are a grand monotony, while Turner's are a dizzy whirl of rushing, writhing, tortured rage, as Ruskin says, an anarchy of enormous power. The sky is roiling soot, as if all the chimneys of London belched their brimstone. Stone smoke at once. The northern seas are crushed beneath this weather. Men, women, boats, mere flotsam. The rescue boat circles the maelstrom. Behind looms the dismasted wreck. It is impossible to know whether the world is being drowned or resurrected. Avalanche, deluge, shipwreck, and fire. As Hazlitt said, They are pictures of nothing. Going to end with one of his later works. When O'Brien comes home, he comes home to a depressed economy. What's worse is photography has been invented. And he tries to set up a shop and teach painting, but I don't think he was entrepreneurial. And he disappears, in fact, for about 20 years. We see nothing that he's done. He's listed in the city directory as a house painter. All of this is in here, but I have to give it as context. One of the curious things about this, his life, and which was irresistible to me as a poet working on a narrative poem, is that the night O'Brien dies, a hurricane strafes Nova Scotia, comes into Halifax Harbor, sinks vessels, destroys the bridge, rail bridge between Halifax and Dartmouth, and then the moon comes out and O'Brien's dead. He's been lying, dying in as a ward of his half-sister in complete poverty and anonymity. And so the whole poem is actually framed irresistibly as he lays dying. There's a reference to this. The other allusion, perhaps, in this poem, which requires some background, is that the tall ships came back to Nova Scotia, as they do periodically, and at the same time they had an exhibition of O'Brien's work, which to me was a great irony. Entering Halifax Harbor, 1881, I too looked inward inside the harbor that had always been my anteroom. The little ferry shuttled shore to shore, men rowed and sailed their home-built boats like emissaries of my own affairs. The city grew around me, unaware of my foundering prospects, failing vision. Still, ships entered my life, looming out of the fog, magnificent in proportion to my misery. If not for your eyes, O'Brien, the harbor, circa 1880, might never have existed. Without an image, the past is lost like a ship not afterward heard of. Your paintings are celebrated in the city's galleries. The harbor fills with gay sails. Again, people throng the wharves, the dock, at your stock and trade. Too late, dead already 100 years. We walk through the hurricane-felled forest where Juan flattened the white pines, as did the unnamed wind that blew as you lay on your deathbed. We look seaward as the tall ships cruise past Point Pleasant, dip once more below the horizon out by Sambro. We wish to sail away, it seems, from our shore-bound lives, like those who went before, who walked from Blue Nose Deck to Blue Nose Deck, down in Monte de Vale or New York. We look to the blue horizon for a new beginning, some old truth about ourselves. Too late, dead already 100 years, we look to you, O'Brien. Thank you. Written one day that Jeff and I went fishing, walked 8 miles down through a river valley, and caught lots of trout, but just got out before dark. Record of a weather-exposed skeleton for Jeffrey Cook. It has a epigraph from Basho. Determined to fall, a weather-exposed skeleton, I cannot help the sore wind blowing through my heart. Already the hay is tinged red. The flowers my daughter picked last week are dry in the vase. In the afternoon, the blinds remain three quarters drawn. Yesterday, I waited at the river, letting the dark water carry away my weariness. On the bank, what did I find but vertebrae shaped like soaring birds? If held to the lips, they might make hollow flute sounds. A skull, long and equine, the knowing mask of some Greek tragedy. A moose skeleton, whole, articulated, as if the old animal had come to drink and simply laid down and died to a single mournful note. Or to symphonic music had been run down to the water's edge, its great rack swinging wildly in the charged air. At dusk, an owl glided through the treetops. A pack of wild dogs yipped in the shadows as if they smelled blood. I walked out of the woods at dark. Exhausted, I sleep past noon. Now the images of the day before return, hard and clean as bone. I listen to the brittle stirrings of the grasses outside the bedroom window. Down the hall, the little song of my daughter's voice in the playroom. Just now, she has picked up the plastic harmonica and begun to play a tune the world has never heard before.